It's Saturday, March 1st, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, a bit about the Week in Geek News and developing social applications with the makers of Yacht Trips.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind, the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today we're covering the geek news of the week, and we're talking about social networking applications with the creators of YachTrips.com, a ride-sharing application which helps individuals find and share their road travel expenses and space. During the second half of the show, we'll welcome you to join the conversation, probably on topic today. You can ask us anything you'd like, actually, but we're going to try to talk about ride-sharing and social applications and things of that nature. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and check out our new website and send us information by clicking Contact Us. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks, Ryder Brooks, support engineer at Sun Microsystems. Morning, Ryder.
Good morning, Lyle.
And our guest today, Swami Nadan. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
We're going to, before we start talking about ride sharing and social application development of Yacht Trips, we're going to go ahead and cover some Week in Geek news. And Ryder, what you got?
Well, interesting development. There has been an issue between Intel and Microsoft of late. Vista, as you know, has a certification program, and they have different designations, Vista Capable and Vista Ready.
And basically, it's kind of more features are
More features, more hardware requirements. The main distinguishment between the two is that Vista Ready has the new Aero Glass interface, which is does require 3D acceleration to get transparency and basically the new touted look and feel of Windows Vista to its full advantage. And it, actually, some versions of Vista you don't even get it, like the Business Edition, maybe Home Edition, but the Ultimate basically has it turned on if you have the hardware.
And so when Vista Capable logo and designation says you can run Vista, but you can't run with those features.
Exactly.
And Vista, what's the one that you can?
Vista Ready.
Vista Ready is the one that's reduced.
Yeah, Vista Ready, Vista, and they sort of changed it, Vista Premium Ready.
Right. But there's a designation there. And the product costs a different amount, or is it just...
No. It's just a designation of the capabilities that your hardware will have with that platform.
And this is basically, you can look up information at Microsoft.com to find out if your current computer can run what version of Vista.
Well, they actually have a certification or a test utility that will give you kind of a report of what your computer will do.
Okay, so what happened?
Well, interesting development came up. There have been lots of internal emails leaked within Microsoft saying, basically, you know, head honchos at Microsoft saying that their main hardware business partner Intel basically has hardware technology that barely functions, and it kind of really negative information about a couple of the integrated graphics chipsets that are included on motherboards that Intel manufactures. Typically the 915 chipset and 945 chipset, namely.
And this is the graphics part of the chipset, right?
Yeah.
Of the motherboard.
Basically what this is it's an economical way of getting graphics on your PC computer, possibly even Macs and other platforms as well. But it's integrated into the motherboard. It uses shared memory with your computer. And it's usually kind of, non-ideal. It's not a gaming chipset typically. It's just for, cruising the internet, basic things like that.
And these chipsets made by Intel. And so Microsoft has kind of internal memos, really, that got leaked?
Yeah, internal memos that got leaked that really had negative information, and it made it look like they were well aware of this hardware deficiency. And what's occurred is that they either got strong-armed or had an agreement with Intel that they would take their 915 chipset and qualify it as Vista's ready.
So this application and you could run on your system that kind of diagnoses, if you had those chips, it would say, you're good.
You're good, and you should be able to run the Aero interface, all the eye candy and whatnot. And in reality, that was not true.
And execs in Microsoft knew this before doing it. It looks like
presumably it looks like that, and there is actually a class action lawsuit against Microsoft for this problem. What it looks like is that they tweaked this utility to make this particular chipset report as Vista ready when it was really only Vista capable and not.
Sounds like they're very culpable on this.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And it's just another example of Vista being kind of a bomb when it comes to operating systems, in that the hardware manufacturers even had trouble getting hardware that would run it. I think it's also interesting that Intel is able to strong on Microsoft. I think of Microsoft as such a behemoth and so much money involved in it, and yet Intel can push it around a bit.
Well, a part of the problem here is that these chipsets are very spread out on vendors.
Right.
People like cheap right. graphics, and it doesn't make it a good video card, but it's on everything. And I remember when I worked at SCO that these 915, 945 chipsets were really just a real headache for us in support, because we didn't have the most current version of the X server for our Unix operating system. And people always had these chipsets on their server platforms, and we could never get them working. We said, you're just going to have to wait till a new release of our X server software. And so it was always a headache, But the big problem here with these is that the 915, has really bad 3D acceleration, if any. And the 945 chipset can do it, but that's about all it can do. It pretty much taxes the hardware to do that.
Wow, pretty amazing that the Microsoft's going to get hit with this so hard.
Yeah.
And, of course, this is probably really good news for AMD and for NVIDIA. Because AMD, of course, has ATI graphics.
Yeah,
manufacturer can run Aero Glass, and NVIDIA, of course, is a major chipset manufacturer and graphics manufacturer.
Yeah. So. And a lot of their integrated graphics chipsets will do this no problem.
I would say pretty much all of them will.
You don't have to have a $300 gaming video card to have the
Aero. So you can still get an Intel Core 2 Duo system with integrated chipset that runs Aero Glass if it's an NVIDIA chipset and not an Intel chipset, Intel has a high-end one.
But yeah, I think they have a higher-end one. I mean, you're going to see this a lot more frequently on laptops and kind of, just integrated chipset and motherboards where, you're getting a cheap $200, $300 computer.
Thank you very much for the story. Another geek is joining us, a student and technical Java developer and, a whole bunch of things. Miles Elam, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning.
Oh, my gosh. You're on 4-3? What are you doing? Oh, there you are. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. What's your news story?
My news story is that Google is giving all San Francisco homeless free voicemail. The idea behind that is that there are a huge number of people that are trying to get back on their feet, and you have a technology company that's offering a lifelong phone number and voicemail to anyone who chooses to accept it, who chooses to have that voicemail. This way, when they go out for a job application, they can put down a contact number, because usually if you come in for a job application, you don't put any contact information on there unless they're going to hire you on the spot. One, they can't contact you, and two, it looks reflects poorly upon you during your application.
Right.
Okay, slightly cynical question. How are they supposed to check their email?
By going to
public libraries, perhaps.
Borrowing from a friend, borrowing a cell phone, public telephones are going the way of the dodo now, so that's a good question. But at the same time, having a number that you'd be able to call for voicemail is still, I think,
because granted, there's a wide category of people that are homeless. Some people have computers. Some people don't. Some people have a place to, friends where they can do this. Some people don't. I mean, I don't, in San Francisco, do they have a lot of internet cafes or?
Well, this isn't, this is an email per se. This is voicemail. So,
voicemail. I'm sorry.
Right. So,
now,
someone at a homeless shelter. I'm sure homeless shelters also have phones available.
Why is Google doing it? For
one,
social justice?
One,
kind of
it's
thing?
Philanthropic. It's social justice. Another one is if you make things more available to a general populace, if you raise the spirits, if you will, of a community, then that community will be more productive.
Yeah.
So it. Yes, it is philanthropic in that case, but that's kind of the reason behind philanthropic.
Yeah.
philanthropy.
Well,
is,
so we don't really know exactly how people are going to be checking the mail checking their voicemail because, of course, the phones are going
to be by whatever phone they can get access
right,
to.
But at least they have ability to be contacted. It's interesting to me that Google's launching a service like this. Do they have voicemail service, or are they expanding their corporate voicemail system to have these? I mean, where are the boxes? Where's the hardware and stuff coming from?
I don't know if Google is hosting this themselves. They may not be. And by the way, this number is supposed to be a lifetime number.
Right.
A homeless person comes up, says, "I want this number," and they have that number forever.
Right. Now, I worked for a company years ago, which then merged with eFax. It's now JFax Communications. eFax. Anyway, it's the conglomerate to some degree, but they offered voicemail boxes that you could check without a real physical phone. And I'm wondering if Google's kind of outsourcing to a company like that and doing it that way, or if they're handling it themselves.
It wouldn't surprise me at all.
It's interesting what Google has this philosophy that a certain percentage of your time as an employee, you get to work on any project you want.
Yeah, 20% of your time.
20% of your time. So basically on Fridays you do that.
And 10%.
10%? Okay, 10%? Half of Fridays.
Yeah. My mistake.
And so this sounds like one of those projects. Someone said, yeah, it'd be great to give everybody a phone number and start it up. That's great. Thank you very much, Miles, for that. Should we do another news story? Ryder, get a good
sure.
One? Okay, go for it.
So now that Blu-ray has basically won the high-definition format war, I think we're going to see a lot more hardware vendors rushing to get Blu-ray technology into laptops and PCs.
Yeah.
Interesting article came up about basically the power consumption in the Blu-ray drives really just kind of sucking laptop batteries very quickly. Like, you know, you're going to have a hard time with many laptop battery capacities to watch a complete movie on your laptop.
Mm-hmm.
And the main reason for that is that the Blu-ray laser involved is really high-powered laser.
Sure.
And consumes more energy than, you know, a DVD drive laser.
That actually was not my understanding. It wasn't the laser, because lasers in general are pretty...
Well, it's a combination of the lasers and also the decoding mechanism.
Yeah,
actually both. I mean, it is definitely a higher power laser, so then, you know, that's going to increase. I don't have
We'll cover a whole bunch more about Blu-ray technology next week. We're going to have a guy from Sony on to talk about Blu-ray.
Well,
DVD,
we can ask him that question.
We can talk all about that and about upgrading your drivers.
In regards to the encoding, you know, the newer, you know, like NVIDIA and AMD have these newer chipsets now that do a lot better job at hardware decoding of this content. So that really offloads it from the CPU. To do that, which I would imagine would reduce the hardware power constraints on that. But there, you know, like I think I read that, you know, there's really only a couple of laptops on the market right now that can actually, you know, watch a couple of movies and you have your battery still lasts like 4 hours, and those are probably honking laptops.
Right.
So. And granted that having dedicated DSPs, dedicated hardware to decoding is going to help matters, but you're still pumping, 30 megs a second constantly and having to decode that.
Yeah.
That, I think, is going to be the major power drain.
Yeah. So for now, you know, it seems like, you know, more people, especially considering, you know, people with home theaters using their computers are going to have, you know, high-definition displays either through their LCD computer monitors or plasma whatnot. You're probably going to want your Blu-ray setup to be on your home computer rather than your laptop, because you're going to be limited to a 15, 17-inch display, which I don't know. You know, high-definition, how much better is that going to look on your laptop? You know?
So for a whole bunch more information about Blu-ray technology, join us next week on the 8th, March 8th at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio. We're going to be talking with Robert DeMoulin from Sony all about Blu-ray DVD technology. And let us go on to our guest today, Swami Nadin. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
And also via phone, we have you're the CEO of Yachtrips, and actually a whole company that also handles Yachtrips. We'll keep talking about that in just a second. Let's also invite your lead developer on from Seattle, I believe. Scott, welcome to GeekSpeak. Hi.
Thank you.
So you've had quite a day running a small business with network issues and stuff, and everything's up and running again?
Yes, it is.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it. So, Swami, you called me about 6 months ago, almost something like that, and said, I want to make this application that reduces carbon emissions as a side effect. But can you explain what Yachtrips is?
Yes. Yachtrips is a ride-sharing application that integrates ride-sharing as well as social networking. And where this issue started is we began to look at some of the problems that we're having with climate change and realized that the simplest, most effective and direct way to impact carbon dioxide emissions is ride sharing or carpooling.
Reducing the amount of cars on the road.
Yeah. Or just, yeah.
Because that's what it effectively does.
Then we had to ask the question, why hasn't it worked?
Yeah.
Because it hasn't worked. So we looked into it very extensively and put together a team of people from different areas, and we began to see that basically existing carpooling applications are extremely rigid, inflexible. Most of them are actually somewhat archaic, and they require compromises of privacy. You have to publish your phone number, for example, with 5m1.org. So what we did is we assembled a team of people, including our chief data architect, Dick Sir, who's one of the foremost data experts in the world. In fact, he shares several, I think a couple patents with one of his former students, Sergey Brin, who's the co-founder of Google. And also Randy Hall, who is one of the leading transportation scientists in the country. He's the vice provost of research advancement at USC. And then we began to look at it from a technology perspective, with Scott and other people on our team. And we realized that if we could solve the problems that are keeping carpooling and ride-sharing from being effective, there's an opportunity to really make a significant difference and impact on our carbon dioxide emissions. For some of our research is...
If most of the ride-sharing applications were really rigid and you grabbed a whole bunch of really good brains and put your minds to the problem, what were some of the things that you made that produced it being less rigid? And what are the things, what are the improvements of the system from that perspective?
Okay, for example, if you go to 511.org, their application takes, there's about a 4 or 5 page application. It takes about 30 minutes to fill out the application and your schedules to sign up.
Forget it. Right.
Scott designed a way where ours is one line, basically. And we just ask, for your email address so we can communicate.
And you can actually look for rides prior to really signing up, right?
Yes.
You get a feeling of how many rides are out there.
Yes, yes. So we wanted to have a very low barrier to entry. So when you want to create a ride for yourself, at that point you sign up for Yatrips, and you can sign up either through your Facebook ID, your Yahoo ID, or through Yatrips, and eventually through Google's Open Social will also support that, once it gets rolling. So our solution is to really make it easy and make it transparent.
So let's say I want to go to San Francisco tomorrow from Santa Cruz. I would go up and enter in Santa Cruz and San Francisco and see if there's anything that was happening tomorrow. That's kind of what we're talking about?
Yeah, on a simple level. We tried to address long trips too, and actually it's a pretty fascinating data issue because it gets extremely complex, because if you want to make it flexible, let's say you want to go from Santa Cruz to L.A., and someone wants a ride from Santa Cruz to San Luis Obispo.
Right.
And then coming back, someone wants to go up 5 instead of 101. So some of the things you have to factor in is how far off your route are you willing to go to give someone a ride,
right?
Things like that. And we want to also address making it simple. And then there are certain things that we really don't have control over, which, if you want to call it, the flake factor of the driver not showing up or the rider not showing up. So I felt that one way to do that was to handle any transaction. And by the way, we don't charge for it, but if riders want to charge for a ride, we have a ride calculator.
Or share gas kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. We can do that. And we enable people to set up their own rates. If it's just a flat rate, like a shuttle from San Jose Airport to Santa Cruz, they can say, oh, I want $15 or whatever. But what we will be doing is that we will be engaging applications like maybe PayPal Mobile or something like that, so the rider and the driver can complete the transaction without any, awkwardness. And then we're trying to make it comfortable and not have it be like a cold experience, but a positive social experience. So we also are incorporating, through the use of Facebook and social networking, the ability to find people with common interests. So if you're looking for a ride and we know, for example, you like the Rolling Stones, we could match people up based on music interests.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we did is that we saw that there some of the issues of inflexibility, to really make it ubiquitous and work well, it has to have the ability to really accommodate people's needs and schedules.
Yeah.
So we did, I think, one of the most important things we did is a feature called Groups. And groups are can be used, they can be private or public. So if you had seven moms who drive their kids to school in the morning and they want to...
They can kind of do it privately.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with a very common commute, maybe coworkers as well is another one of those examples.
Yeah, or, you know, college students, young women who don't want to publish their phone numbers and things like that.
Now, do you publish any of... I mean, can I go up there, set up a situation, set up a ride, and basically... Until someone contacts me through the system, I'm not publishing in my information. Is that privacy enabled?
Yes. Privacy is a very important thing. The groups, if you're doing a group, you can say this group is public or private.
Right.
You can define.
Well, let's talk with your head developer, Scott. You're a Ruby on Rails developer, Scott. Would you define yourself as that?
Well, yes. I mean, I've got a team that we focus exclusively on Ruby on Rails applications. So yes, that's a good characterization.
And what size is the team that worked on this application? How long did it take you guys?
Well, we've been in development for about the last 2.5-3 months, and our team right now is a total of 4 people. So this one had 2 developers basically under 2.5-3 months. And the primary systems that we had to develop and interact with were Google Maps, because we've done an extensive overlay where once you kind of had the question, how do I create a ride? Well, you go into the system, you enter where you're taking off from and where you're heading towards, and then that instantly gets plotted on Google Maps. You get a route that also has full traffic information, so you could see the actual traffic movements that are occurring over that route. So it was basically the entire application was built in Ruby on Rails. We interact with Google Maps for all the API work. And then, of course, we did a deep Facebook integration, which is both a Facebook application. And you can also just show up to the website and use your Facebook credentials to quickly log in.
Is that
interacting with the system?
Right. Is that using OpenID to do that, or does Facebook have a very specific login procedure?
Well, we actually support several different logins: OpenID, Facebook, Yahoo, and also just creating a login via Yatrips. Mm-hmm. But Facebook supports its own authorization.
Right.
So it's. I mean, you could say it's competitive to OpenID, but it is a different authorization system. So we've kind of created a neutral platform where you can choose either Facebook, OpenID, Yahoo, or just a standalone authorization.
Right. So I'm pretty familiar with Google Maps, and one of the things you can do is once you get your ride, you can actually kind of specify different versions of that ride to either, you know, do more scenic route or of that kind of nature. Can you do that and then come back to Yatrips and then have that be published? I mean, are you actually using the Google Map data to define what the route is?
We are using the Google Map data to define what the ride is. Right now, of course, you can switch between, you know, satellite, hybrid, and other views.
Mm-hmm.
In the future, we are going to be supporting things like alternate routes. So
okay.
If you wanted to adjust and, you know, go out of the most efficient route, you might want to stop at a friend's house.
Right.
So we are going to be supporting that in the future.
Now, how did you solve the problem of I want to go from, you know, Santa Cruz to Los Angeles, and someone else wants to go from San Luis Obispo to Los Angeles, and, you know, how do you pull those two data elements together so that we find each other?
Well, I mean, part of the solution is a social one, in that once you're kind of participating in the social system, you can browse and review the different rides that are available, because some of it is somewhat of a human problem. I mean, I might know that I want to go from Los Angeles to San Francisco, potentially I want to go through San Luis Obispo or through the 5. So we do allow people to basically search and find anything that might be, you know, a variation of the current ride that they're looking for.
So to some degree, it uses the intelligence of the individual to kind of know that there's a couple routes? Or is
well,
it more like you can kind of talk
there,
about it?
Yes, there's basically a system level that helps to connect these people, but I'm just suggesting that there's other ways that people can browse and explore based on interest or based on, you know, variation of that particular ride that they're looking for.
All right, I want to actually do some station business. We're going to keep talking about Yatrips, and you're welcome to call in. I'll give the numbers in a second to ask about ride sharing, Ruby on Rails development, or integration with different Web 2.0 companies, if you will. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. KUSP co-sponsors UCSC Arts and Lectures presentation of R. Buckminster's Fuller, The History and Mystery of the Universe, featuring Joe Spano, Bucky Fuller, has been called a crank, America's finest engineering saint, and the Leonardo da Vinci of the 20th century. This performance explores Bucky's life and work through a blend of testimony, lecture, poetry, and comic antics. Joe Spano escorts you on this unforgettable journey. This performance comes to the UCSC Main Stage Theater in Santa Cruz on Friday, March 14th at 8 p.m. Information at 459-2159 or online at artslectures.ucsc.edu. GeekSpeak on KOSP is sponsored by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're welcome to call the geeks right now and talk about social networking applications, road trips and ride sharing, issues of Ruby on Rails development, and other things that kind of fall in that line with the creators of yachttrips.com. The geeks today, Miles Elam and Ryder Brooks. I'm Lyle Troxell. We are now taking your calls. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. Of course, you can use the internet. Just go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. All right, we'll go ahead and start taking calls in on topic, I think, today. And you were about to say something, Swami?
Yeah, part of what we're doing to address that issue are data algorithms. For example, when we will define how far out of a way, out of one's route they're willing to go. Mm-hmm. And that's where it really kind of gets, to make it simple up front, is very complex in the back end. And addressing that so we can be proactive and not only allow people to take initiative. We could be proactive saying, well, this person's within 10 miles of the freeway of where you want to go. Are you willing to go out of your way to get that person? But if I might want to mention that,
yeah.
One of the interesting things in doing this research, in fact, we have an interesting blog site that I would encourage people to look at. And Kumar, who's our director of important stuff, wrote a blog about...
Is that his official title?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, that he said he's not a rocket scientist, but his friend Amber is. And she calculated that in America, we drive 2.4 trillion miles a year and produce over 2.2 trillion pounds of carbon dioxide.
Man.
And when you reduce that down to, let's say, just someone who is basically works in an office and drives a Ford Focus, just in the course of 1 year, she puts out over 12,000 pounds of carbon dioxide. And in weight, that equals one slightly undernourished Tyrannosaurus rex monster. They weighed about 13,000 pounds. But it is a monster of a problem.
Uh-huh.
And what we think is that if you look at the U.S. government established miles per gallon standards in 1985 at around 27.5 miles per gallon. And it's anticipated by 2020 to change to, I believe it's 33 or 35 miles per gallon. So over a course of 35 years, that's been the government's contribution. If three people get in the car and take a ride tomorrow, they're effectively getting about 65 miles per gallon. And that
comparatively
would take,
to driving themselves.
Yeah, and it would take the government, at the rate it's going, 140 years to legislate that. So,
so that's the motivation factors.
Yeah, and I think actually, you know, people feel the need to contribute and participate. And I think the in terms of a global perspective, and by the way, if you want to find a ride from Shanghai to Canton, you can use Yacht Trips to do that. It's global. But an interesting factor is that I think, you know, people here do want to make a difference. And I think it's quite possible to do this and use Yacht Trips to actually make a significant difference in the world. And I personally believe that the greatest American ambassador over the last 200 years has been the goodness of the American people.
I want to ask you about Yacht Trips' interface. I haven't had a lot of time to play with it. And one of the things that I think would be very useful is that, you know, I have a daily commute, and I'd like to hook in my daily commute about my times, about the thing, and just set that up as a general and let people contact me if they happen to be, you know, matching my commute somehow.
Yeah.
And just have it kind of an ongoing thing. Do you support that?
Absolutely. For example, Thursday I was down in Mission Street about 4 6:30, and I had to go out to Aptos. It took me 45 minutes, and I realized, and I'm usually on the west side, but that's a perfect example of how yacht trips could be used, because that corridor is taking all the traffic from the industrial complex on the west side and UCSC. And really, this is something that Randy Hall pointed out. A very interesting thing is that in the United States and our traffic infrastructure, it's really somewhat limited, and and the alternative routes are also limited. So the slightest increase in traffic makes a significant difference as far as is congestion. And conversely so, the slightest decrease in traffic would ease it up. So we posed the question, taking a corridor like L.A., what would it take to make a significant, noticeable difference in traffic in Los Angeles, which everybody agrees is probably one of the worst in the world? And it came up 1%.
So if 1% of the people doing the road travel would share, it would all of a sudden, everybody would get there faster.
They would notice it.
Yeah.
It'd be a noticeable difference.
Well, that makes sense.
So you can use, for example, we have connection points. Like, for people, let's say, who would want to commute, let's say, from UCSC, let's say you could commute to the Cost Plus parking lot.
Right.
Or to one on Soquel by Rite Aid or something like that. Or if you're going over the hill, for example, and you have to go to Mountain View, you could drive to Campbell and have a connection point at the beginning of 85, use the carpool lane with people, and come back and then drive your own car back. So it doesn't have to be all or nothing.
Do you – what about the issue of – you know, I've done this a few times now, let's say, and now I want to you know, I want to kind of grow my network or whatever. But I don't want to spend the amount of time it takes to kind of get to know somebody and actually trust that there's somebody I want to travel with. I'd rather kind of see what other people have said about them. Do you have that kind of ranking system where people have gotten approvals and such?
Yeah, we do have. Scott can go into it in a little detail. But we do have feedback that we're going to be including. Because there's a lot of issues. You might like the person, but their car might break down all the time and you get to work late.
Sure,
you know, simple
sure.
things. You know, kind of neutral issues, but
well, let's go ahead and take some calls with great questions from Watsonville. Judith, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question. I don't really drive hardly at all myself, and so sometimes I'm needing to find ride places. And one of the things I have a dental appointment that I'm supposed to schedule up in Sebastopol, but the problem is I don't know how to get there. Would the system work to try and get a ride for something like that, do you think?
Yeah, actually, it'll first of all, and thanks for calling in, it'll give you directions to get from where you are to where you need to go. Also, as Scott mentioned earlier, we also put real-time traffic overlays, so you know what the real-time traffic issues are en route. And you could put that you need a ride, and anybody who is going in that direction or going on there could certainly contact you.
Now, here's a big thing. For Judith, for example, she wants a dentist appointment. Probably, Judith, you're going to be there for 2-3 hours, something like that, depending on what you're doing. But she needs a ride up. She also needs a ride back down. And getting a ride one direction kind of puts her in a pretty bad situation. So how does that get resolved?
Well, one of the issues would be that she could qualify that, you know, that she does need a ride in both directions, and obviously until she's able to get that. There's really an issue here of critical mass.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, it's sort of like the phone system, you know, two people using the phone is very useless.
Right.
So the critical mass issue is something that is key. And once that exists, we feel this will be ubiquitous, that there'll be enough people that literally you'll be able to – the concept actually is that you'll be able to go out and use something like Twitter or, you know, a Facebook mobile and just say, you know, I need a ride from my Berkeley apartment to campus.
Right.
And there'll be enough people to do that.
And that's one of those things that you start understanding about social engineering and social applications, that if you're doing it and it's, you know, public roads and stuff, there are probably 50 other people that are doing the exact same thing Judith are doing on the same day, you know? So it's a matter of getting enough people involved in the system so that it becomes very easy. Hey, Judith, I'd love it if you gave it a try. If you just go to yatrips.com, that's yatrips.com, and go ahead and put in your system. I know you listen to GeekSpeak pretty regularly. You've called in with a lot of great questions in the past. I'd love to get your feeling on whether it works and stuff. Now, it's very possible you won't find a ride because
part of it is I don't want to schedule the appointment unless I can know I can get there.
That's a good point.
That's the part.
So how
long before do you usually be able to find out if the ride if somebody's going to go.
Yeah, how long do you...
Because, I mean, I could, you know, if I could, then I could schedule and I know a couple days ahead or a week ahead that I definitely don't have a ride, then I cancel it.
Well, I think in your case, and that's, I think you're giving a really good specific example that is somewhat isolated, that it's out of the norm. I would give it a little more time than usual.
Uh-huh.
I mean, for close rides and commutes, you know, maybe, hopefully it would be within hours or whatever. But in your case, I would say even several days or, you know, a week or perhaps even longer, because you also want to ride back. And someone may contact you and say, look, I can do this at such and such a time. So that would give you, you know, adequate time. And we would hope as more people would use it, that this will actually, you know, become easier to schedule rides on a more regular basis. So one of the ways we realize these issues and one of the ways we're trying to do this is that we've implemented a program called a Million Miles Less campaign.
Yeah.
And we're encouraging people to use it. And we keep track of how many miles and how many pounds of carbon dioxide a person saves by using yacht trips. And it's either by individual or by a group you're in or a network, or let's say a downtown movie theater is going to give people a discount if they share rides downtown. And we're hoping that people will take this as an objective, because if we get 20,000 people, to give you an example, to just ride share for 50 miles each, that's 1 million miles, and that takes out of the atmosphere and reduces our carbon dioxide emissions by 917,000 pounds.
I just want to say I think it's a great thing you're doing to try and get this going. I've been trying to do ride sharing of one sort and another as I could over a period of time. Now I can't drive myself very much, but I know it's such an important issue, and so thank you very much.
Thank you, Judith, very much for the call. Yeah, thank you. Well, let's go ahead and take another call. We'll go ahead and go to, Carmel, why not? Lloyd, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the call.
Pleasure. What's your question?
My question relates to whether the founders of Yacht Trips have pitched their software and their program to municipalities and corporations.
That's a really good question. Yes, we have spoken to some. And I had a very interesting conversation. There was a blog that was written on Huffington Post by a person named Ben Rosen. And I sent him an email. He had said he spent quite a bit of time thinking about this several years. And it didn't ring a bell until I realized who Ben Rosen was. And I sent him an email on a Sunday, and he called me back, and we had a nice, long conversation. Anyway, Ben Rosen funded Compaq Computers. So he legitimized the clone PC. He funded Lotus Development, legitimized the spreadsheet, and he funded Silicon Graphics. And he's been said to be one of the 10 greatest contributors to technology. He was chairman of Caltech University, and while he began to see they were having real traffic problems and traffic issues. So he wrote this really beautiful blog about this, and I think you can find it on Huffington Post. And we spoke about it, and he felt this was a top-down solution where you had to get governments involved. Mm-hmm. And he's been very frustrated with that effort. So I wrote to him and said, look, in all respect, I think this is a bottoms-up movement also. I think, the success of the iPod, I've got young kids, and I can tell you, it didn't start with adults. 2 years before adults had strings hanging out of their ears, you know, kids were sharing music on an iPod. And I think it's a bottoms-up, grassroots possibility as well. And municipalities, for sure. I mean, there are, even if you look at, like, you know, people who work in government organizations, for example, what I mentioned earlier in Los Angeles, the top five employers are government agencies, and they employ over 300,000 people. And if people were given credit, let's say, instead of having to sit in a conference room, they were given credit so you could, if you carpool or rideshare, you could actually work in the car for an hour either way. There is also a mandate where they have to participate. But Ben said he had a hell of a time getting companies and municipalities to participate. And he went into one, and he asked what their rideshare program was, and the lady pulled a folder out of her desk, and she, you know, would just look at pieces of paper and call people. And that's he said there wasn't a system, and when we talked, he was pretty happy there.
Lloyd, you bring up a really good point, and Swami, I really like that you've talked about let's do it from the grassroots. We've actually had Paul McGrath on, who's a friend of mine from Santa Cruz, and he has a site called Ridespring.com, which is a focus at corporate level and government level. So it's basically his tagline is the company-specific alternative commute service. So it's company-specific, you know, which does make sense in a lot of ways. So if you have a large enough organization, the organization can say, you know, if you use the sharing, you get better parking. There's other things that, you know, benefits the company can do. But it's better than that manila envelope that a lot of them do. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going pretty well for him. You know, he's able to quit his job and do the same type of thing. And the thing that I guess next, because the critical mass is so important, it seems to me that an integration between services makes a lot of sense. And now I want to get back and get to that. I know how his model works in the finance aspect. First off, let me say thank you very much, Lloyd, for the call.
Well, if I may just add, we all may be aware that back before the fall of the dot-com world in 2001, that Cisco was intending to put an 18,000-person campus in Coyote Valley, and that threw them into a big legal wrangle with counties and municipalities to the south. And the problem was that people were going to have to commute from the south, and which created a great revenue burden on those counties and municipalities. And I would think that something like this could easily have been embraced at that time.
Right, as a solution to the traffic concerns, for example.
As a solution to ease the problems. And this, thinking of critical mass, I became aware of this right after 9/11, when listening to NPR one day, Manhattan had put a hammer down on traveling into the city. They required that no car would be allowed in unless there were three people in the car. And that was protested by the advertising guild of that borough because the advertising guild realized that if there's more than one person in the car, people wouldn't be listening to the radio, and thus ratings would go down.
Interesting. And well, Lloyd, thank you so much for the call. I want to go on with the topic at hand. Thank you very much for calling.
Along.
All right. So Ridespring.com, which basically makes an organization contract, and the corporation pays them to manage the ride-serving services between individuals so people can commute and save money and all that. That makes – I get that model. How do you guys work? Because you're not charging a percentage of the costs of the travel or anything. How are you making money?
Yeah. Well, actually, that's a really good question because
thank you very much.
Yeah. Because it's the – first of many applications that we're building and developing. And our whole focus is to really to meet the needs, transportation needs of individuals in many different ways. What you did mention also is that when we work with municipalities and corporations, you know, that is an issue that has some monetary compensation as well. You have large companies like Walmart trying to address the issue, and I don't know, they're a good example because they're rural stores, they must have a lot of employee miles driven every week to get there. But in addition to that, I mean, we have other applications and services that we want to provide to people who ride share that can help them in many ways related to transportation.
Okay.
And none of those would impact the consumer, but basically because we offer these and if we have critical mass, then we're able to provide vendors in a similar way to provide discounts to these people.
So you're kind of doing the classic Web 2.0 startup idea. Get a giant amount of audience and then leverage that audience to pull in a little revenue. Because honestly, I mean, you have some staff and you have some web service issues, but you don't have a giant corporate infrastructure. You don't have buildings you have to pay for and stuff. So kind of a small amount of money actually allows you to keep going.
Yeah, but there are other things too that we will provide consumers in a sense. For example, you know, people can keep track of their mileage. And for example, when it's time, for example, for someone to change their oil, I mean, you know, we could provide coupons and things like that, have targeted advertising. We do have a very sophisticated model in the background on this, but it's completely transparent. And our real focus, essentially, as the company, we're just talking about Yacht Trips, but it's part of Yatra Motors, which has a much larger scope of what it's doing. But our whole focus, essentially, is somewhat similar in a sense, to Costco. We're very consumer-driven, protecting the consumer, protecting privacy, and then if we ever offer business opportunities for services or things like that, because of the consumer base, these vendors will have to provide it at the lowest possible cost to our consumers.
Sense. All right, well, thank you. We'll go ahead and take another call. Let's go to Big Sur. Jim, welcome to Geek Speak. Hi, Jim. Did I surprise you? Oh, that Jim's off air. Rich from SoCal.
Oh, hi.
Hi, so sorry.
I have a question about liability here. I mean, I've been involved in a couple big companies in the past that got afraid to arrange ride sharing when they're, you know, because if something bad happens, who gets sued? And when you're talking about doing this on a mass scale, aren't you running the risk that Charles Manson could be using your system to find victims?
Or even reduce that fear of, you know, some psychopath or anything. Let's go ahead and just deal with the one person sets up, does a ride, another person's in the car, and the driver has an accident that's their fault.
Okay.
Is your company's Yacht Trips, you know, is it liable at all for that? You
no,
set up the arrangement.
No. We've done a significant amount of research in that area, and, you know, we're not liable. I mean, it's based on the advice of our, you know, legal counsel that we're basically facilitating this, but we're not responsible for the acts of others. But the question that you ask about some psycho or something like that, these are part of the issues we've addressed with privacy and security, which is a very tough issue to solve because you want to make it open and free, but you want to also provide as much protection as you can. And that's where we think the value of social networking. I mean, if you use sites like LinkedIn and stuff, you know, I think you'll find that you're not more than 3 degrees removed from almost anybody. You know, if you know 46 people, chances are, if you're 3 degrees removed, that group expands to well over a million.
Meaning, for example, in Facebook, where you might not know the person you're going to share a ride with, but that
someone
person dated
might.
Someone you know for 2 years. And
right.
So you're like, oh, I know who they are. I mean, it's
safe. Yeah, that's the whole purpose of leveraging the social networking. And in a sense, what we're doing is this is the first time, I think, for example, with Facebook, that we're actually taking the social networking phenomena and actually applying it, you know, in the physical world, so that people can have positive social experiences leveraging their experiences online.
But I guess I'm missing something here. So if you can have all the online privacy protections that you want, but you're actually getting two people physically within touching distance of each other. Isn't there a line being crossed there somewhere? I guess the other thing is this what the online dating services obviously must have to deal with this. So I guess there's some law, there's something set up for this?
No, I mean, Yahoo Personals, I mean, they facilitate people to meet. They can't control what happens.
Right, so have they ever been sued, do you know?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah. I totally get your concern. It makes a lot of sense, Rich. Thank you so much for the question.
Sure.
All right. We did have a call off air from Big Sur. Jim wants to know about ride sharing and personal security concerns, which are pretty much handled. What about the flag the weirdo kind of thing? Let's say someone, you know, gets into the system and you share a ride and your experience with them is so bad that you want to tell the network. And so you tell the network somehow, right? You rate the experience bad. And then there's a conflict of whose reality is correct there. How do you trust who? And how do you do that in the system from like a programming perspective?
Well, I think we have to be transparent. You know, and I think in that regard, you know, you allow people to air their complaints, and in all fairness, you have to, you know, allow people to respond to that. But I would think, as an individual, if I read something, just like buying something on eBay, if you find a few instances where you're buying something and the guy didn't deliver it, you might not want to do business with him. And I think if there was, you know, question, you might refrain from wanting to ride with that person.
Right, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Ryder, you have a question?
Yeah, I was curious about kind of the uptake. How long has the site been up, and have you seen pretty dramatic growth? I mean, because clearly this seems like a service that, for it to really be highly successful, needs a lot of contributors and a lot of flexibility to, you know, getting routes. You know.
Yeah, it does. It does need, and it's growing, you know, little by little. It's growing, it's growing slowly, and it's been up pretty much. We did like a soft launch probably just before Christmas, before the end of the year, and it does take time. I mean, that is, the two most difficult problems was to make a very, very complex technology issues simple to use for people, and two, to get critical mass and getting people to use it.
Let's go ahead and go to your developer, Scott. Scott, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Oh,
thank you so much for being patient. I hope that you're able to multitask and do some work at the same time as you're with us, because I know you're a very busy person. But, Scott, how is it that Ruby on Rails application development environment helped in this project? I'm a Rails developer myself, and I have a lot of faith in it to some degree.
I mean, primarily, it's obviously a highly social application that we've built, so it's social at multiple levels. Social at the consumers who are interacting, posting rides into the system, connecting with others who are interested in either providing a ride or taking those rides. It's also social at the application level. I mean, obviously, we've done a lot to marry it early on with being able to run as a standalone site and also run as a Facebook application in that environment. And then, of course, the other interactions that we're doing via Google Maps. So given the highly social nature of the application, it was pretty much a natural fit for us. I guess I'd also add that I've been doing this for ballpark about 12-plus years, which are kind of, you know, large-scale web applications, and literally right out of college, the first thing I did was a major Java application, and then, you know, after that, subsequent to that, I've done a handful of PHP and other projects, and at this point, I exclusively do Rails projects because I just think it's the best way to develop applications. Obviously, go ahead.
Yeah, well, how many controllers do you have in this application, for example?
It's limited. I'd think about 12 or 14.
So I would take it from that you're not doing REST development in Rails.
No, it is a RESTful application.
Really? Wow. Yeah. That seems like a
It's just that it's, you know, we just constantly are kind of simplifying and breaking it down to the core elements of what the application needed to do.
And what about scaling? I mean, you're dealing with Ruby on Rails applications not known for the best. You basically need to put a lot of hardware. Do you have a lot of hardware behind it?
No, there's not substantial hardware. I mean, we've done a lot to optimize the application, and, you know, I think in the marketplace there's kind of varied opinions as to how well certain applications scale versus others. Primarily, what we've experienced in the past is more of a database bottleneck than we have at the application level within Rails. But, I mean, certainly looking at things like Twitter, you know, you have a huge number of users interacting with a system, and it is built in Rails, and it's proven to be effective. And again, most of the things they're dealing with that are scale issues are more at the messaging level than they are any specific problems that they're running into with Rails. So I think, you know, it's a challenge, but, you know, scaling any application has its challenges, and, you know, whether it's PHP or Rails or others, you're still going to be doing a number of things to, you know, to optimize those applications and constantly rethink and refactor as you're adding in more users.
So you don't see a need for doing kind of thinking of Rails as a rapid development environment and then going, okay, now that we've got this whole data model set up, we really know what we're doing exactly right. Here are some things that would run better in C, and let's recode them.
No, that's not our approach. But not to say that we wouldn't, you know, at the messaging level or some other infrastructure level in the future, consider optimizing something. But no, we've been very happy with Rails.
And also, too, if I can just add, one of the reasons we made this decision to use Rails is that we want to be very proactive and responsive to user feedback. And I think that's one of the big benefits of Rails, is that we can actually respond and make changes and make improvements, because we certainly don't think, you know, we've invented everything. We're going to learn as we go with this, and we want to be able to respond quickly.
Makes sense. Well, I want to thank both of you very much for joining us. Swami Nadin is the CEO of Yatra Motors, right?
Yes.
And the primary product right now that they've launched is yatrips.com. You can learn a whole bunch more, including bios for both of our guests, up at geekspeak.org. And take a look at our new website, which we launched this last week. I've been doing a lot of work on it. Hopefully it will stay up. And Scott Rosnick, thank you so much for being on Geekspeak via phone. I really appreciate it as well. All right.
Thank you.
Certainly. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Now that HD DVD is dead, is it time to get a Blu-ray player for your home, for your computer? Find out with Geeks during the detailed discussion with Robert DeMoulin from Sony Electronics on March 8th's episode. That's next week at 10 a.m. here on Central Coast Public Radio. The Geeks this morning were Miles Elam and Ryder Brooks. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
And answering the phone, as it is every week, Rick Philman, thank you so much for helping GeekSpeak work. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Thank you very much for listening to GeekSpeak. We will be here next week. You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.